Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Carver Watson with Let's Talk.
We acknowledge the sovereignty of all First Nations people right across the country. We acknowledge elders, elders of the First People, and elders of more recent arrivals. We also acknowledge our old people, the ones who have gone before us. Welcome to all of our listeners tuned in across the National Indigenous Radio Service. And wherever you are, if you're tuned in or streaming via the web or later via the podcast, welcome to Let's Talk. I'm joined in the studio this morning by Dylan Chown. Morning, Dylan.
Morning, Carver.
Mate, as is customary, we ask all of our guests where they come from.
Thanks, mate. Look, I grew up in Brisbane. Family, my mother's side, originally from the Darling Downs area, Scottish sort of immigrants, become farmers and worked their way down to the Big Smoke. My dad's side from England. So I've grown and grew up, I guess, Turrbal and Jagera land. And I work now in Adelaide, so I also conduct some of my business on the Kaurna people, traditional lands.
Mm.
So that's my... I'm not an Indigenous man, but that's my my mob.
So what do you do for work?
I'm in education, which means I don't work. Never thought about it as work. It's sort of a... I don't know, it's a passion. I feel really deeply about it. I feel like it aligns with our purpose of being here. The higher purpose, and been in education for 20 years. I started out as a PE teacher, which means you're pretty flexible, pretty organic with what you do. Mm. I went out bush first, went out to Longreach, spent a couple of years out there, and I guess learned how to teach. I came back here and worked in the Juvenile Detention Centre for a while, and obviously for the young people in there, PE is a pretty important part of the day. You build really strong relationships there. I went on to spend about 5 years in Inala, Glenala High, and then later at the Annex, which was an off-site school for disengaged youth and so on and so forth. Around about that time, and you'd know this because we did it together, I reached out because I was teaching Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander kids in the main, and naturally you want to reach your kids. There's this old saying, if you can't reach, you can't teach. I think badminton was on the program when I first got there, and it just wasn't reaching, so to speak. So we looked out for Murray Games and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Games. And that began the journey that I took the great privilege of taking with yourself and another brother, Troy Meston. And we ended up, my role, of course, was to, I guess, work with young people and upskill them as to sort of how to be facilitators, how to be train the trainers. And now, as you know, our young people, most of them were Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people, became the, as rightly so, the ambassadors of those games. And they ended up teaching those games to people in university, to Australian Sports Commission, Sport and Recreation, and so on and so forth. So I spent maybe the best part of 5 years doing that, working in communities, travelling around Queensland. From there, I had a bit of a change in my personal life. I accepted Islam, and I thought, well, look, I'd love to keep teaching because this is who I am, but I'd also like to learn a little bit more about my faith. So I then entered an Islamic school in Brisbane and spent the next 10 years there. They were an emerging school, new school, and I had the privilege of setting up the health and physical education department there and getting young people involved in sport and in community and on their way. And it's very, as you know, you yourself worked with a lot of young people. It's very empowering. I was just listening to Uncle Charlie yesterday, Watson, who was telling us he's got so much hope for the young people, and I think that's what a lot of teachers feel too. So that's where I spent my sort of 20 years or so in education. I'm now a research fellow at the Centre for Islamic Thought and Education, which is at the University of South Australia, and I'm sort of coming between Queensland and Adelaide.
You're commuting from SA...
SA,
to
yeah,
Brisbane.
Wow. To Brisbane, yeah. And travelling around a bit, I mean, I never really desired to be an academic. Didn't do it for the title or the big chair or whatever. I did it because...
You're sitting in one now.
Yeah, I know. Thanks, mate. Yeah, I did it because I think there's gaps. And I think as you get older, you sense that you have that sense of responsibility that you know, you carry the lessons your teachers gave you, but then gradually that sense of responsibility you start to assume. And for me, it's important that I'm plugged into schools. No sense being some guy in a university writing out papers and telling people how it should be done.
In a lab coat.
In a lab coat, exactly. You've got to be on the ground listening to the people at the coalface, which are the teachers. And ultimately we're here for the students. So
what is your role as a research fellow of the Islamic...
Centre for Islamic Thought and Education. Yeah. We call it SITE. It's SITE. Nice and short,
okay.
SITE.
Yeah, I'll remember that.
Yeah, look, it's a broad role. I'm very, privileged to be, the Program Director for Islamic Education. And, look, there are 55 independent Islamic schools. I guess those of you would know the Murray School as a very...
well-known independent school.
Absolutely. And you know, your father and all your family involved in that. So the listeners would be, you know, understand the role and the importance of independent schooling as a positive choice for people. And I guess not dissimilar to parents at the Murray School that would want to see not only quality education, but they want to see the honouring of cultural, linguistic and you know, heritage passed on to their kids. And I guess the Australian Muslim parents feel in a similar way, that they value the cultural and linguistic and religious aspects of an education. So my role is to develop teacher training. And I think...
For the Islamic schools or for...
For both.
Non-Indigenous teachers.
Yeah, In Australia, about 20% of Australian Muslim kids, or maybe even under, between 15 and 20%, attend Islamic schools, independent schools. The other 80% attend mainstream schools. So I guess we do both. We look at cultural and religious competency for teachers in state schools or other schools who in some places in Australia, they're finding more and more Australian Muslim kids in their classroom. And all good teachers, I said before, you know, you have to reach to teach. And I guess we're fielding a lot of inquiries around how to meet the needs of Australian Muslim kids. That's one role. And the other role is to provide teacher training within an Islamic worldview, but cognizant with the, or connected, I should say, to the Australian context. So that's one role. The other role is to...
That sounds like a difficult role because, I mean, all of our listeners and most people are well aware of the tensions with, you know, things like Islamophobia and those sorts of issues. So you're straddling these sort of two worlds, if you will, trying to find some sort of dialogue and similarities to engage in dialogue. Absolutely. I'd imagine that'd be quite difficult.
It is quite difficult and... I guess we're in a, and this would be, you know, to people who identify as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, that probably people, I should say, they would connect and relate to this in their own way. And I don't like to conflate the two stories because each person's struggle is to be honoured and is unique in that sense. However, I guess there's those identity politics which have a massive impact. Every child that we teach in a classroom is a post 9/11 Australian Muslim kid. And for them, the post 9/11 world is a very different place, from before that, and that has a big impact on identity and belonging. And we have that confusion. It's a famous quote. I don't remember it word for word, but I remember Aunty Lilla Watson talks about when Murrays operate outside of their terms of reference, they lose that sense of self. They become they lose that confidence because they're not operating within their own terms. And if I can take that as an analogy for a lot of the experience of Australian Muslim kids who are, you know, are being questioned, are being told they don't belong, or being told you belong when you're like this. As a community, we're in a reactive state where we're constantly reacting and telling people who we're not, and I fear that's not a strength-based approach. We're not actually sharing who we are and not acknowledging that we've had a long-standing connection in this country, first and foremost with the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, with the McCussons and so on, which was largely a positive experience. So we're not new to the country, but it's how we engage in that space, I guess, and it's difficult for young people. All young people are going through, no matter where you're from, what your background is, we all know that young people go through that stage of finding themselves, and it's increasingly difficult for Muslim kids. It is difficult. What we're trying to do is provide an evidence base. We see every other day in the media some sort of headline, you know, that gets everyone's attention, creates fear, generates fear, feeds off fear. But when you really peel that back, there's not a lot of evidence to support any of what is said. Mm. And we're trying to provide an evidence base for what we do.
I want to get to the how and how you're doing that. But you spoke earlier about your passion for education. And, you know, from what you're saying and the reasons and your role now is still about providing an appropriate and safe space for young people to learn. Is that what the passion is?
Absolutely. And I spent a lot of time in schools. I spent last week in a school in Sydney, an Islamic school in Sydney, and we're in Brisbane as we speak. So I get to travel a lot and see schools, but for me it was a sacrifice. What I'm doing now, I had to leave the classroom, and I had, you know, very special. I had special students. Students that I'm getting old now, they're getting married and they invite me to their weddings and so on. I had to forgo that special relationship because I wanted to look at
the
bigger picture. And that's why I guess we're focused in and around teacher training as well as research in the field. We, in Islamic education, need to do those three things. We need to, one, ground ourselves in our own tradition. So we're in our own terms of reference. So we're operating in our own worldview. Two, we need to be cognizant of the Australian context and all the Australian standards, whether be they AITSL, professional teaching standards, be they the ACARA national curriculum, so on, so the more formal sorts of things. And three, we need to have a deep understanding of context. And that's what brought me here today, because I'm trying to understand context. I'm trying to understand increase my, I guess, competency around First Nation peoples, because I think that's essential. Without that, we won't go forward as a community.
Mm. What is the relationship between that you see with Muslim communities and Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander communities across the country?
The relationship, well, I mean, I can answer that in a few ways. I guess I tend to look at it deeply. I'm not supposing that I'm looking at it deeply, but I look at it at a bird's eye view. I'm trying to, and I look at it that if we come together on purpose. Now, purpose is important because that connects back to our way of knowing. And Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, as you know, and you've taught me, in fact, have a distinct worldview, and it connects to their way of knowing. In the Islamic worldview, same. There was an ontology or an origin of knowing, a way of knowing. Now, for us, that relates to purpose, our purpose here. And I've heard your father say, Uncle Ross, purpose is about being full human, about being honourable here. And I guess in the Islamic worldview, purpose is to please the Creator by fulfilling all our obligations here to people, to land, and to the Creator himself, you know, as a non-gendered entity. Now, that sounds heavy, so let me sort of try and explain what I mean, that for us to fulfill purpose, for us to please the Creator, and for us to fulfill our obligations to land, people, animals, and so on, I'm of the view that we need to have a better understanding of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples because our purpose relates to here, place. We're here in Australia and we're not here for an accident. People of faith don't believe in coincidence. So the Creator put us here to fulfil our purpose, and we're on land that, 60,000 conservatively years old, and you've got an old ways of knowing here and people that fulfilled that are what we would call amana, which is Arabic word for responsibility. That's been fulfilled here for 60,000 years. And until we establish better relationships and draw on, there's a famous saying in the Islamic faith that knowledge is the lost property of a believer. You should pick it up wherever you find it. And I don't think yet I think for us to discover our full humanness, to know what it, and that's ultimately our life's purpose, then we need to have a better relationship and a better understanding. And very important, I think, we want to be very careful that we don't come here and prosper and become another layer of oppression, if you like, unwittingly. Muslim peoples, you know, come from all places of the globe, but many of them have come suffering from colonisation. I don't need to explain to listeners here that colonisation is not in the past tense. It's ongoing. And for Muslim peoples, you know, in certain countries, particularly in the Middle East, have suffered recent and ongoing colonisation, which has had an impact on Muslim peoples. The danger if we come here, unless we work on that, we can become another layer. And that's something I feel passionately about, that I don't want to see our community in that light. More practically, I guess your question is, what's the relationship? Look, I'm constantly making an effort. I guess I'm privileged that I've had access to elders. And I make a point wherever I go. I work in Melbourne, Adelaide, Brisbane. One of the first things I do, which is what my elders have taught me, is to connect with the elders of that region, to let them know what I'm doing, or what sort of business I'm intending to do, and just begin a conversation. And that's what I tend to do, and we've done that in all places we've worked. And that's something that I practice, and I guess I enjoy that relationship, and I'm open to learning and ready to do that. And that's
The conversation is very, very important, you know, and our old people have always been conscientious of the need to engage, especially with people who come from other countries and are living in Australia. One of my aunts always used to say, if you call this place home, then you should make the effort to learn and understand what it is to be a part of this country, you know, and that includes that history, that 60,000 years. So what is the response that you get when you go to MOB to talk about what it is you're doing?
Really positive. I'm surprised. I guess, I don't sort of launch into business. Obviously, the first thing I do is sort of, you know, share who I am and where my family are from and what I'm on about. And
what we're doing now.
Exactly what we're doing now, yeah. And that's... And, you know, I remember in Melbourne, I booked a meeting with the elders there, the Wurundjeri people, and when I walked in, Uncle said, you know, look, I've got 5 minutes only. And I said, no worries, Uncle, I'll take that. And I think we were finished an hour and a half later. So. And, you know, it snowballed. So
the power of relationships is very, it's powerful, you know, the importance of relationships. Because that understanding and acceptance of people, it's coming together on those similarities, you know. And we all have politics, we all have our own views on things, but, you know, when we can come together on the things that we agree on and the Absolutely. Things that affect ourselves and our communities, it's important to build a better country.
Absolutely. And half of the, in the Islamic worldview, half of faith is relationships. And we've been talking here, yesterday and again today about relationships and Aboriginal and Torres Islander peoples. It's just mind-boggling, really, to think about the complex, sophisticated system of relationships that was here, and that's enduring. And when you asked me what it was like to sort of meet. You know, I'm meeting people cold. You know, I don't know them and they don't know me, but we begin that conversation. We share who we are, where we're from and who our mob are. And that's such a powerful thing for building relationships. And that's at the ground level, that's so important, especially when media's and politics and things are quite confusing, I think, for people, conflicting messages, messages. So I think face-to-face... and building of relationships in communities is probably, you know, more important than ever.
That breakdown in relationships and dialogue, people say, you know, and at the risk of sounding a little bit overly critical, that term divide and conquer, it's... I remember studying at university. There's a Latin equivalent of it, and it has long been a form of system of control of people about focusing on difference and focusing on power structures and hierarchy to create that disharmony to better govern people. And I'm not saying that there's people out there that are intentionally thinking about causing division, but I certainly think it's become a part of the practice and a part of the norm of the way society operates. You know, we become isolated and work in silos. And have a critical view and gaze upon other people who look different, who speak different. Or, you know, whatever the difference is. It sounds like, you know, we all in our own ways are trying to create better relationships and cut out that division.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you nailed it with the word other. Mm. Once you other people, it's a very dangerous thing, because when you when someone becomes the other, people don't afford them the same human rights, I guess, or even beyond that, beyond rights.
Empathy,
yeah, absolutely. Mercy. And there's obvious historical consequences of that. And I think I imagine that's how large sections of the Muslim community are feeling in Australia. They're feeling othered. And, you know, that as an educator, going back to what we do in the classroom, it's about kids finding who they are and understanding that their purpose is here in Australia. And as you were mentioning about Auntie, understanding what that responsibility entails. So, yeah, absolutely. It's building down. We seem to be in an era where we're looking for a pan-Australian identity or a mono sort of everything will be fine if we're all the same way. And I don't think that's a sophisticated society. If you take Aboriginal and Torres Islander peoples, they were extremely diverse. They had autonomy within each and every nation. Mm. Obviously, there were common there was a common worldview. There were common ethics and so on, and logic and so on and so forth. But there was great diversity, and we weren't afraid of that diversity. It seems now that we're in a period where there's an uncomfortability around difference and an unwilling to recognise where we do, in fact, come together. And who doesn't agree with fair go? Who doesn't agree with justice? Who doesn't agree with mercy? I've never met anyone would dispute those higher objectives.
The flip side to that difference also is that people become very insular, you know, that it becomes a part of their identity to be joined to other people and feel part of a group by looking at somebody as another,
yeah.
You know. And so it's not just the effects that go onto that sort of minority group, whoever they are, whether it be Murrays, Muslims, you know, in the early 90s it was people of Asian descent.
Yeah.
It's not just those groups that become isolated. It's the people who are doing the isolating.
That's the thing I think's missed. You know, every other day you'll see, if I was to take the Muslim community, that on, you know, the typical programs that are on mainstream telly or TV, every other day that's every headline, every sort of segment is pushing that agenda of fear and difference. And what I think sad is that all of our humanity is at stake. It's not just, I mean, the Muslim community might be feeling the brunt, or the Aboriginal and Torres Islander community might feel the brunt, or as you mentioned, the Asian community might feel this, but ultimately we're all of us, if we're living in a society that hasn't become mature and hasn't reached that stage where there are, you know, a mature society, then everyone's humanity is limited.
Mm.
And I don't think that's discussed. I think it's always thought that the minority, it's up to them to sort of pull themselves up. And I don't think that's, I think that's very narrow tunnel vision.
So we thought we'd get to the how and talk a bit about now how you're going about that and part of the reason why you're here today. So for our listeners out there, we've got a black card on today. The aunties are working with academics from a few different tertiary institutions and talking about, you know, Murray philosophy and history and everything that goes with it. Why are you here doing that?
Look, I guess I had the privilege of hearing from only Lil and only Mary for many years, and I've read some of their work. You know, and I've you know, it's really inspiring. It's really, you know, it. Yeah, what do you say? It's just sort of a next level. So we spent the day yesterday, and it was, and again today, which I'm looking forward to. And I came because I think it's important. To you know, remain previously, I guess I was connected in communities, you know, and I had when we were part of Blackbase, which was an Aboriginal and Torres Islander mentoring organisation for young people. The same elders were sort of overseeing what we were doing, and I kind of got to learn firsthand, I guess. And it's been some time since those years, so I wanted to come back and do Black Card. And increase cultural competency and hopefully take that back to where I'm working and who I'm working with, and That's the intention.
Is there similarities you see between the space, in dealing with common misconceptions of the Muslim community that our communities face?
Look, as I mentioned, there are definitely similarities, and I see a lot of them. I'm always careful and try to be respectful, never to conflate the two narratives, two stories.
You've been pulled up before, eh?
yeah, learn the first time. And, it's not the way, So it's, you need to, because I only have whatever understanding I have of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander experience. And I guess I have a lived experience of what it means to be an Australian Muslim. But I'm 10 years in, and I'm by no means an elder or a leader. I'm a lay believer. But I guess so many similarities. Number one, I guess, are the myths around. And yesterday, some of the aunties were talking about a lot of the unchallenged misconceptions about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, which they were able to unpack and obliterate, really. And there are many going around about Muslim peoples in Australia. The other thing is, I guess, that we're a really researched people. So we're beginning to see in this generation particularly so-called experts coming around and researching Muslim peoples, Muslim communities, or Islamic theories from their own terms of reference or from their own worldviews, and then I guess starting to create policies under the guise of surveillance or de-radicalisation or paternalistic sort of concern. And that window is beginning to open. So we're beginning to see not a strength-based approach. We're being sidelined our ways of knowing and our what we bring, how we walk in the world, so to speak, to quote only Deb Bennett, who talks about this sort of stuff from an Aboriginal perspective. We're beginning to see that research, and I guess we're trying to fill that gap that we're researchers, but as we often say, we're at your weddings. We stand in your prayer lines together. We come to to funerals. When the sorry business in the Muslim community is on, we're not sitting in an ivory tower and coming and looking at our community to inspect it or as a means of, as a hobby. We are, action research. We're engaged where we can, not always in action research, but we're engaged as people that belong.
Telling your own story and being participating in that.
Absolutely.
In that yarn. It's the same foundations of why Aboriginal media, Indigenous media exists.
Yeah.
It's the importance and the understanding that without that voice and our people and our communities telling our own story, that our narrative and the conception out there will always be biased and not accurate. Is this what your thesis is about? You're currently undertaking a thesis. Tell us what the...
Sure. I guess one of the things that's missing, and I'm trying to fill a gap, when anyone starts a thesis, they see it like a Nobel Peace Prize. I guess they want to save the world with 20,000 or 80,000 words or what it might be. And I guess I've pegged back and I've identified that what's missing is people, researchers who are educators. So my studies are looking at the emergence of Islamic pedagogy. Now, pedagogy is one of those buzzwords. But I guess if we assume it means the science and art of teaching or what's going on, and even more broadly, how we're teaching. You mentioned we're interested about the how. So I'm interested in an Islamic school, what impact that has on the culture of the school, what's unique about an Islamic school. I'm interested in the structure of the school, how does it set up differently. And I've visited the Murray School with you, and the Murray School's over its time has obviously negotiated a certain structure based around what it means to be a Murray School. So I'm interested in that in an Islamic school. Also interested in what's responsive pedagogy. A couple of researchers and colleagues, Associate Professor Rob Hattam, and someone who'd be well known to listeners, very respected and esteemed Aboriginal researcher, Professor Irabina Rigney, and they look at culturally responsive pedagogy, and they're looking at that in classrooms where there are high volume of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students. So we're beginning to work together, and we're looking at culturally responsive pedagogy for classrooms that have have got people with different knowledges, beliefs, traditions and values, and what they bring to the classroom. And I think that's something we share with the Aboriginal worldview that, and it's, you know, I think we've had this conversation before, and this is something I always usually say at end of year graduations to the kids that are leaving school. You know the story of the American chief, the American Indian, indigenous man. And he was a very wise man. They asked him about his school experience because being so wise and being known for his wisdom and his impact, they assumed he must be educated, of course. They asked him about that. He said, no, I left school very early. He said, why? And he said, well, my teacher told me that if, you know, I work really hard, one day I can be someone. So the chief left the next day because he thought, well, I already am somebody. And this is something that's stuck with me for the best part of a decade, I guess, when I heard that. These kids are somebody. They, when they come in that door and they come to the classroom, they're already bringing their knowledge, values, beliefs, traditions. And I think culturally responsive pedagogy is an acknowledgement of that. And that's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in how do we, what's quality teaching for the kids in the classroom? That's sort of what my PhD is. I'm very interested about it, of course. So thanks for asking, mate. But most people sort of tune out as I start talking about that.
It's interesting to hear you say that because you are a non-Indigenous person and you found, you know, Islam later in life. So as a non-Indigenous person, you know, of probably, you know, of European descent, what are your thoughts about the need for this culturally appropriate education as well as dialogue between mainstream Australians and, you know, Muslims, Aboriginal people and all different sort of multicultural groups?
Yeah.
Because you are probably, you know, you had the same sort of education as most people did in Holland Park, and surrounds.
Yeah, Campbell.
Yeah. I mean, so I have a view that it's a great disservice that our education system has in a lot of ways failed, not only people of our, you know, of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities and mob, but also, you know, people of European descent. I think it's a great disservice that we're having to have these conversations and still bridge these gaps, for lack of a better phrase. What are your thoughts on that as a non-Indigenous person?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head, and we care for all kids in classrooms. I don't know I certainly didn't walk in the classroom and sort of focus on certain kids over other kids. I certainly hope not. And I think you're right. We're looking at an education system that's, I think, underpinned by very neoliberal values and mass testing or mass schooling and then standardised testing, NAPLAN, ranking schools and so on and so forth. This era, which has ushered in these practices, I think is, for some researchers and certainly myself, who's sort of heavily in the social justice paradigm, these things are problematic. And they're having a big impact on the nature of education for all kids, and they're having a direct impact on the approach to teaching, what's going on in classrooms, and it has, you know, greater impact in certain schools. And there are certain efforts around that I guess challenge those that sort of mainstream approach. Now, be it a Murray school, be it an independent school, but also we see how popular are Montessori schools. Or Waldorf schools or Steiner schools, or, you know, so there are different, and homeschooling is obviously a popular option for some parents. So, yeah, I think it's problematic, and going back, you know, as a non-Indigenous man, as you mentioned, it's, I think certain things, and until we really reconcile that relationship with First Nation peoples, I don't think we'll, in terms of harmony, in terms of understanding this current sort of, I wouldn't say crisis, but this current sort of period that we're in where we're very uncomfortable around refugees, we're uncomfortable around people of difference. Muslim peoples are said to be, you know, always criticised for sort of being counter to Australian values despite flourishing and living here for, you know, for many years and having a long-standing presence here. Despite the fact that they're disproportionately mentioned in sort of matters of safety and what have you. You know, that's all of those factors, and just reconciling difference, understanding that people bring something different, and what it means to be an Australian may not be a pan Australian image any longer, but we might have to come together on some higher values around honourable relationships.
We spoke about, you know, one of our other hosts, Dr. Chelsea Bond, and, you know, we spoke a lot around the 26th of January and, you know, the change of the date, sort of Australia Day, Invasion Day debate. And, you know, she said something quite that I sort of quite agree with looking back on it. And, you know, if this country is not prepared to change the date and acknowledge that history, then, you know, that more so, that more or less speaks to where we are now as a country, you know. And it's important to have those sort of, I guess, markers in that we have an idea of where we are as a country and where that conversation is.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that we don't keep working towards changing it and do our bit, but it's important not to feel distressed or completely out of hope because of those minor setbacks.
I think that's the work of people, you know, people like ourselves are working in community, and certainly that's what I hear from the elders of all communities. You know, hope. And that sort of requires vision. You mentioned earlier about media, and as you were sitting there talking, I couldn't help but think of your old man, Uncle Ross, and he was saying that how many years? I think he saw it before many other people saw it. So we're sitting here, and where do we see our community in 20, 30 years? And the seeds essentially need to be planted today. I think as Annie Lilla also says, you know, we may not selfishly see that in our generation, but still we're responsible for planting those seeds. We have high hopes. And I think it's what you mentioned too, it's about honesty. So I sometimes say in our community, sometimes someone like Senator Pauline Hanson, who I think everyone is familiar with, quite well known. Yeah, she may make certain comments, particularly around, you know, directed toward the Muslim community, and that has an impact on particularly young people. But I don't know. I'm of the view that it's better that these, and I'm not suggesting she's. It'd be preferable that she didn't make these comments. But seeing as though she is, let's work from a strength, and let's say, well, okay, she's voicing something that, in our perspective, is lacking any evidence, which is huge generalisations, which is unhelpful, probably has an agenda, and really isn't going to take us anywhere. But one thing it will do is that it's voicing where we are at now, as you just said. So to take the analogy with the 26th, it's better that we know that this is where everyone is. And like in teaching, this is something I think we experienced, and I've worked, I mean, I'm here and I learn and I've engaged in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, but when you go further afield to other communities, you see that people are further back in the field, and we have to bring them with us. And it's like teaching. You can't race ahead and leave kids, you know, 100 metres behind. We have to bring people along with
us.
To go together, and that's going to take time. So I think we need to plant the seeds. I agree with you.
This is essentially what your thesis is about then, you know. It's about growing together, you know, filling in some of the gaps of that conversation to assist in a dialogue and settling on our similarities and what we have in common. Mate, it's been great having you here today. Thanks for dropping in.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
No worries. And you've been listening to Let's Talk. We will be back tomorrow and we'll catch you then.
You've been tuned to Let's Talk, highlighting the injustice from community to country, suburb to city, with a multitude of hosts, Bo Spearham, Carver Watson, the aunties Lilla Watson and Mary Graham, and Chelsea Bond. Weekday mornings from 9 till 10, it's Let's Talk, welcoming the continued sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country.